Headliner Radio, the creative voice.
Hello and welcome to Headliner Radio, where we're delighted to be joined by Dylan Southern and Will Lovelace, the filmmakers behind the Blur documentary film No Distance Left to Run, the LCD Sound System concert film Shut Up and Play the Hits, and most recently Meet Me in the Bathroom. In cinemas from March the 10th, Meet Me in the Bathroom is inspired by Lizzie Goodman's book of the same name and takes an in-depth look at the indie rock scene that exploded in and around New York City at the start of the millennium via extensive interviews with and archive footage of some of the key artists and individuals of the era. Dylan and Will, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you both and whereabouts are you joining us from?
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for having us. This is Will. We are both not in the same place, but both in southeast London.
And we're both fine, I think.
Yes, so we are.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And firstly, congratulations on the film. It's been, I watched it a couple of days ago and absolutely loved it. You know, as someone who was a big fan of the book and it was quite, you know, invested in that scene at the time as well, I thought it was absolutely fascinating to kind of see what you'd done with all those interviews and archive footage and, you know, and how you'd adapted that book, because it's an extensive source material, that, isn't it? It's a big book. There's a lot of stuff in there to kind of delve into and work with. So I kind of wanted to ask, Firstly, how you came to be involved and decide to, you know, embark on this project, but how you first set about actually making this film and making sense of what was quite a sort of crazy and chaotic time.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it is quite a heavy tome. So, you know, the adaptation of it was an interesting kind of challenge. But in terms of how we first came across it, there was an interesting sort of serendipitous thing that when Lizzie had the idea to write the book, she was actually in attendance at LCD's at the time last ever show at Madison Square Garden, which we were in attendance making the film Shut Up and Play the Hits. So in the audience somewhere, Lizzie was there, and it was at that moment that it hit her to the idea to kind of make an oral history of this period of music. You know, cut to 10 years later, and we managed to get hold of a copy of the galleys of the book from a friend who worked at the publishers. And we weren't sure that we were going to do another music documentary, because, you know, there were other stories that we were interested in telling. But when we read the galleys, it was such kind of a rich sort of time, you know, and it's sort of scary that 20 years had passed. It just didn't feel like it. And it felt like a sort of a good moment to reappraise that moment in musical history. It also, at the time we first read the book, it felt unlikely a moment like that could ever happen again, just because of how much the world had changed in the intervening years. So from that perspective, we thought, you know, as the book does, you could make a film that, as much as it's about the characters and the bands and the music, it also gives you a time capsule for a period that isn't that long ago, but the world has changed so much since then. Hmm. I guess, yeah, the process was, we were like, well, God, this is long. It kind of covers 10 years. We knew that we couldn't put all of that into a 90-minute film, and we knew we couldn't be as sort of forensic as the book was. So our whole thing was like, well, let's create a time capsule. You know, we can't tell the beginning to end story of all of these bands. We can't, you know, dive into what followed next. Let's do the origin story and those first 3 years, you know, when these bands emerged. And probably the most exciting section of the book as well is, you know, that sense of people coming to the city or being in the city and there being this sea change and this need for something to happen in the culture. And the fact that it happened at a moment in history when the world's eyes were on New York as well, it was kind of fascinating to us.
Yeah, it was a particularly fascinating time for music, but also culturally and socially as well, for, you know, obvious reasons with the events that happened on 9/11. But also, you know, as you address in the film as well, shortly after that, you had the widespread sort of adoption of file sharing and things like that, which sort of obviously started, was the beginning of the complete transformation of the music industry as we know it now. I was curious to know what your individual sort of recollections and experiences were of that time? You know, were you, you know, back in 2000, 2001, were you especially kind of into or interested in the music scene that was bubbling away in New York at the time? Was it something that you were come to more recently as, you know, taken an interest in as a result of making the film? What was your experience of the music and the culture of that time?
Well, I mean, Dylan and I were both up in Liverpool, actually, at that time, filming bands, you know, not necessarily as successful as these bands, but, you know, trying to sort of make stuff with bands. And I remember very well all of this music, you know, coming into our conscious, you know, like Dylan often would bring these records into like the office where we're working. And so I sort of distinctly remember seeing some of the covers, you know, like the Yeah Yeahs record, the Interpol record, the Strokes record, that stuff. And I think it was suddenly it just felt quite exciting. And I can't really remember exactly what was happening before that, but I really remember hearing this music and thinking, and, you know, obviously the NME and other magazines were running stories about New York and the music scene that was happening there. So it definitely, you know, we were a similar kind of age to some of these bands, so it felt like, I don't know, it felt like this is a good story for us to tell in that respect as well.
I think it was also, at the time, it was hard not to feel a part of the scene because it kind of felt like it was happening in England, because, you know, the success stories of all of these bands all involve, you know, England first. England kind of were the first country to give the Strokes a record deal. You know, they all toured over here, and it was almost like, you know, there was this scene happening in New York, but sort of a rite of passage was to come to England. And I think the music press at the time, you know, Britpop had kind of died its death, and that there was a bit of a vacuum culturally, and the music press in England loves a scene to get behind. And I think it was just kind of a perfect storm at that point. Yeah, and I remember, I'd never been to New York, but I remember going to New York in 2002, mainly because I wanted to kind of visit some of the places that I've been reading about. And I had a particular fondness for the anti-folk scene, the Moldy Peaches and Jeffrey Lewis, and, you know, the more sort of DIY side of things.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, what was your, you know, going through these, you know, interviews, archive footage from the time, all that kind of, the material you used to put this film together, how did it feel to revisit it? Because you can always, there's always a sense with particular movements and musical scenes or cultural scenes that when you have that bit of distance, there can be a bit of revisionism. It can almost feel a little bit like, has it been romanticized? Is it, do you view it with, you know, rose-tinted goggles as this kind of big cultural explosion? Was there any sense that was the case with this, that we've almost not romanticized it, but do you get the sense that it felt as vibrant and kind of exciting as it seems now? Was it actually like that at the time? Were you able to get any sort of sense of that from the footage and the interviews that you were conducting for this?
I think yes and no, because I think, you know, if you asked any of the bands if they were part of a scene at the time, you know, it wasn't like they were all hanging out together and they were sort of doing their own things and there were intersections and stuff. But, you know, it was it seems genuinely from the archive that we saw that it was a very exciting time to be young in New York City. It wasn't necessarily that, you know, hey, there's this scene and we all go to this bar or you know, on a Tuesday night. And I think, you know, there is that sort of mythology, but that was something we were interested in exploring, the notion of how, like, individual lives become part of a city's kind of cultural mythology. And we didn't shy away from it, but we didn't want to make a film that represented it in a way that wasn't accurate in a way. So yes, I think there was a scene and I think it was exciting, but I think it was experienced less holistically than perhaps the British press made it out, you know, looking at it from through the pages of NME or Q magazine or whatever it was at the time. I think it was easy for them to package in that sense, that there's this New York scene happening and all these bands hang out together. And, you know, and I think the reality is always a little bit different. It doesn't mean it wasn't an exciting time, and that there wasn't something vital happening in the music. But I like the fact that there were lots of sort of different mini scenes in a way. You had the whole like Brooklyn kind of more art school kind of, you know, vibe, and then the sort of East Village rock and roll, and then you've got the anti-folk scene, and then you've got DFA, you know, making forays into dance music, and it kind of encapsulated what, you know, it's the end of one thing and the beginning of another, you know, culturally, technologically, everything. So that was the thing that interested us, just, you know, not necessarily sort of the scene, but what the time and the place, how it allowed those disparate things to emerge and be looked at all over the world.
I was gonna say I think one thing as well that kind of comes across in the footage that we managed to get hold of is, it obviously it feels like such a different time, you know, it feels like when it looks like a long time ago, but what was interesting was because no one's got mobile phones and no one's being filmed all of the time, it feels like it's a bit freer. You know, people weren't worried about being filmed or, you know, social media didn't exist, obviously. So I think there's something in that in terms of like the energy of it feels very different. It feels like a freer place to be somehow.
It's weird. Despite all the sort of partying and drugs and stuff, it feels weirdly more innocent. There's sort of less self-consciousness, less like, yeah, you know, I'm being viewed by the entire world. It feels like the last time that could happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was going to come onto that and ask about, you know, the you know, whether it's possible for a scene to kick off in that kind of way again. And I think that is, and I would argue probably not, and that's due to, I think, the lack of social media and, you know, mobile phones and stuff at the time, because that kind of excitement and I guess hysteria that would have been created at that point is something that almost exists through word of mouth, where you know that you might only get to see these people on a stage at a particular venue at a particular time. You don't get that daily dose of seeing what they're up to on social media, all that kind of stuff. They exist there in the moment and it, you know, tangibly in front of you, and that's kind of it. And then once that's finished, it's gone until the next show or the next record. And I wonder if that will sort of hamper the excitement around a particular scene taking off like that again. I don't know. I guess time will tell. But
yeah, and yeah. I think, you know, there's always going to be exciting stuff happening, but you know, it'll just happen differently now, and we're probably too old to kind of
yeah. You as we've spoken about, you do document the kind of social backdrop to what was happening at the time, technological backdrop. For people that perhaps weren't there at the time or weren't of an age where they could fully appreciate what was going on, could you just contextualize for people what the backdrop was to that music that was being made? Because there might be people who have grown up since then who are into the Strokes or into Pearl or the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, but might not be fully aware of what was going on in New York City at that time, and how perhaps without the social and cultural backdrop, you wouldn't have had the ingredients for that movement to kick off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the, in the film, lots of the characters sort of talk about this sense of there being a bit of a void of, you know, stuff they were into, music they were into, that there was a bit of a vacuum, and they were all kind of individually, you know, searching out something different. And that, I think that certainly helped allow these bands to kind of make the music that they made, that, you know, they weren't at that point necessarily just following the people who had done the thing just before them. They were trying to sort of figure out their own way, make their own way. So I think that certainly helped that. Yeah. Like I think Dylan said earlier, that felt like there was sort of lack of of interesting stuff happening, and certainly the guys
certainly in this world. I mean, obviously there was like stuff happening in hip hop and dance music and vibrant like musical culture in different genres in the city. But I think for the sort of characters in the film, they they weren't finding in culture what they were looking for. If you think about musically at that time, it was all the sort of I forget what you call the genre, the Limp Bizkits and
the new metal,
yeah. That sort of rap rock, really incredibly corny thing that, you know, as it looks today, but that was the guitar music of the time. And I think, you know, there was just a sort of vacuum waiting to be filled. And, you know, and the music they were making obviously had its roots in sort of New York music of the past. So it wasn't completely groundbreaking, but it was new enough and of its time enough that it kind of, you know, broke through. But then, you know, and then James and DFA, the sort of dance side of things is really interesting as well, because, you know, again, there's a British infusion there with David Holmes and Tim Goldsworthy kind of crossing paths with a drummer in a punk band turned engineer in a music studio, and that kicked off a whole other thing. And I think one of the things we were really interested in are what are the sort of coincidences, and the you know, for anything to happen, there has to be a set of correlating events before. And that's the thing that I always find interesting in music books and music films is, you know, what were the ingredients that got us to this point where this thing emerged? And the fact that those things are ephemeral as well, you know, I think there was a review, maybe it was in The Guardian, and the journalist described this time as a flashbulb moment before everything changed. And there really was that feeling that the best part of this music scene happened very quickly. And then as things do, you know, all the usual cliches of bands falling out and excesses and all that kind of thing come in. But, and we always used a quote from Lizzie's introduction to the book as a guiding principle as well, which she said, for a few short years, we were chasing New York. And for, I'm getting this wrong. Well, how does it go? We were all chasing New York, and for a few short years, we caught it. And that was kind of, you know, a guiding principle was, we kind of looked at the story we're telling as coming of age stories for each of the bands. And, you know, some really fit into that genre. And, you know, the idea of Karen as quite a shy girl coming to a new city and transforming and almost having this split personality. And then, you know, how long you can sustain being that wild. You know, so we kind of looked for story arcs that fitted into the time and place that, you know, are kind of universal in a way.
Yeah. I found one of the stories I find particularly fascinating is James Murphy's story, because it kind of flies a little bit in opposition to to his contemporaries at that point, you know, whereas you had the Strokes and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Interpol and, you know, Moldy Peaches, they were these kind of young, kind of exciting characters, if you like. He was someone who was that little bit older, and it seems that felt quite disillusioned with where his place in that world was, you know. And there's that bit in the film where he kind of talks about playing I'm Losing My Edge for the first time, and it's just like, no, don't play this to people, you know. He's almost kind of at the end of his journey. You feel like it could have finished for him almost at that point, whereas it actually starts to take off at the point where the others have almost have not had their peak necessarily creatively, but they've had a couple of years or so of that massive bubble around them of being the you know, most exciting new act. And I found his story is slightly at odds with everyone else's, and I found that really interesting. So I just wanted to see really what your observations were on his story, and then as a second part to that, how it felt revisiting the birth of LCD Sound System, having so brilliantly documented what we all thought was the end of LCD Sound System. Obviously that didn't turn out to be quite the case, but yeah, if that all makes sense as a double part question, I'd like to put that one to you.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, James's story is, you know, it was happening at the same time, but it is very different than the other, you know, people that featured in the film, for sure. You know, he was doing his own thing. Well, actually, he was kind of, I suppose, trying to figure out what it was he was going to do. And, you know, that's what we actually really liked about the sort of two stories running alongside each other. You know, he's doing his own thing completely separate from everyone else.
And almost the accidental nature of it as well, because, you know, the Strokes arrive as a sort of fully formed, you know, band that just that's all they've got in their sights, is to be a really great band. And, you know, Karen O has this urge to perform. Interpol are kind of workmanlike, really, really like want to be a successful band. And James just kind of, you know, gets there through a series of failures in one thing or another, or, you know, coming up against someone in opposition. I feel like he creates in opposition to people, you know. So when David Holmes comes on the scene and he's like, this guy doesn't know how to play instruments, I could do what he does. I don't know. We really liked his story as a story, because he's kind of as hard as he is to work with for some people, and as like sort of single-minded as he can be when he's being creative, like he kind of is the underdog in the story in a way, in that he's 10, you know, 15 years older in some cases than some of the other people in the story, and doesn't look like things are going his way. And then suddenly, you know, he's the last man standing, really, when you look at kind of sort of popularity now. And, you know, I think that's why it was interesting. And then in terms of revisiting LCD and doing the origin story, that was one thing at the beginning we were kind of, you know, do we want to tread the same ground again? But we felt, you know, Sharp and Play the Hits is a concept film, and it is capturing a single moment. It's not telling the protracted story of the band or really delving too much into anything other than James's decision at the time to end the band. We always liked that. It was sort of that, saw that as a kind of midlife crisis in reverse. You know, most people hit 40 and decide to start a band. He hit 40 and decided to end his. So there was something really psychologically interesting about that decision that he made. But sort of going back to the beginning, at first we were sort of like, do we want to do that? But then as we kind of talked about the film more and more, it became obvious that it was one of the sort of strongest stories in terms of him as a character, but then also in terms of one of the themes of the film being like the changes in technology and changes in the way that people consume music. And James recognized that very, very early. You know, Losing My Edge is all about that. It's all about the kids coming out from behind, and, you know, all of this effort and work he's put in to like build this eclectic taste in music. Kids can just press a button and download albums that he's searched in record shops for years in the click of a button. So yeah, it felt like it was necessary for the story, because it as you say, it was a counterpoint to the other bands, but it also spoke to some of the sort of underlying themes of the film as well.
Yeah. Are you surprised at how many of the bands are still making music and going? Because often with these kind of scenes and movements, there's a tendency, it feels like, for it to kind of, you know, crashes and burns a little bit for certain bands. It's, you know, huge explosion. Then the fact that we're, you know, 20 odd years down the line and the Strokes have still, you know, been playing shows, Interpol are still fairly regularly putting out music, LCD Sound System, you know, back from the dead, released a brilliant album a few years ago now. The Yeah still making music together. Was that something that almost felt a little bit surprising to you in some ways, that after that huge, you know, explosion of a scene, it was, and, you know, it was quite wild as well. You know, there's a lot of excess and things going on at that point. Do you feel surprised in any way that many of these are still together and putting out solid music 20 years on?
I think that having sort of now got to know their characters a bit, that doesn't surprise me. You know, I think they're all kind of creative forces who just want to, you know, look forward and make stuff, you know. And I think they've all kind of reinvented themselves as they've gone. So I don't know. That doesn't really surprise me. I know what you mean, because often a scene finishes and then that's it. But yeah, I think it's exciting that they're still making stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I think we expect different things from artists now as well. I think, like, in the past, there was a sense that the you know, people bringing an album out 20 years after their heyday, that it wasn't going to be as good as what went before. And I don't know exactly why it is, but I think because everything ever is available to everybody all the time now, like, you know, it, things seem slightly more timeless. I don't know. It's weird, but yeah.
Well, are there any, just, you know, purely as a, you know, as fans perhaps, are there any particular records from that era that have really stood up especially well for you that you still, you know, are big fans of, or still would revisit and listen to? I just wondered what your personal sort of favorites and tastes were from that era.
I mean, First Strokes album stands up, you know. I think that's probably one of the strongest debut albums ever.
I think yeah, first Fever to Tell as well. That sounds like it's still a, you know, amazing record. I mean they kind of all are, really. It was actually really, that part of it was amazing to be able to go back and listen to all that music again and like hear live versions of stuff that we hadn't heard before, and you know, and those conversations in the edit were happening the whole time, sort of which tracks are the ones that, you know.
I feel like it's the bands that come shortly after that don't age well, you know, because immediately as that thing started happening, a couple of years later, you get all the bands who are in the record label have gone, oh, we need another Strokes, or we need another, you know, so you end up with, you know, Kings of Leon, who I remember being great at the time, but I can't imagine sticking on a Kings of Leon album now. You know, I think there's something about that sort of, you know, the scene that emerges after the scene is always the one that kind of doesn't really stand the test of time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. You can trace that to any sort of definable scene, whether it's Britpop or grunge or whatever you want to, you know, wherever you want to look, there is that kind of slew of bands that follow you're right, never really stand up. I was also curious to see what your thoughts were on how and where Interpol kind of slotted into all of this, because I've always found them quite fascinating in that they were clearly one of the staples of that scene, but they feel stylistically with regard to their music and their appearance is quite at odds with, you know, the kind of slightly wild rock and roll look of, you know, whether it's the Yeah Yeah Yeahs or the Strokes, the FA scene, Moldy Peaches, you know, the quite an English sound, more perhaps arguably more so, some might say, than a New York sound. They felt quite British in some ways. And then, you know, there's the suits and the slick hair and Carlos as this, you know, goth gunslinger kind of character, you know, they were in a similar way to, not similar to James Murphy, but in the way that he felt slightly at odds with what was going on around, I felt like Interpol had a similar position in that they weren't quite in step with everything else, but they were still a major part of it. I just wondered what your observations were on how they kind of assimilated into that scene and became such a part of it, while they kind of stuck out like a bit of a sore thumb as well.
I'd agree.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, I think they, like, in a different way, but like James, they were sort of the underdogs of the sort of guitar scene, you know, and I think they just had a clear vision of what they wanted to do. And they were sort of, whilst everyone else was exploding like the Strokes, they were sort of, you know, a year or two behind or a little way behind in terms of becoming, you know, successful, but they just carried on and sort of did it, you know.
Very kind of tortoise and the hare kind of thing, isn't it, that they you know, I would see Interpol as like, they really worked at being a band. They really put the effort in crafting the songs and, you know, doing the steps that you had to do back at that point. And I guess they just hit differently to you know, as you say, the aesthetic was completely different. The sounds, you know, there's elements of Joy Division in there. There's like a very British kind of feel to it. And I think, again, I think England also played an integral part in, you know, their development as well, you know, in terms of the press over here getting behind them and putting them in with that scene. You know, they were suddenly, if journalists are mentioning their name next to the Strokes, next to, you know, the other music that was happening at that point, then they sort of become a de facto part of the scene, regardless of the fact that they are so different.
Yeah. Cool. And I know that at the start you said that before beginning work on this film, you weren't necessarily looking at doing another music film. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you've had any thoughts as to what your next project might be. And if it's kind of reignited any sort of sense of looking at other, you know, eras of music or artists, or perhaps you might want to take a look at, or do you think you would definitely want to take a different direction with whatever you take on next?
Well, I think if we do another music documentary, it would have to be kind of take a different form, because I guess with the Blur documentary, that was kind of traditional, you know, story of a band documentary, although we sort of interweaved it with the story of their reunion and Graham and Damon becoming friends again. Then Shop and Play the Hits was a concert film. And then this one is archive only, you know, which is a very different way of making a film. So I think if we were to do another one, it would be about reinventing the form of it and not just doing something straight. So it'd have to be the right story. And at the moment, we're sort of focusing on non-music projects, but if the right thing came along, we sort of never say never.
Dylan and Will, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Headliner Radio, supporting the creative community.